Welcome to the Dork Forest. Jackie and her pals will never bore us. Shameless confessions
about our obsession
will make us laugh and smile. So let's explore the Dork Forest and dork out for a while.
Hey, it's Jackie Cation. Welcome to the Dork Forest. You remember the Dork Forest. We're a podcast, me and you. You know the websites, JackieCation.com, DorkForest.com, TheDorkForest.com. It's December 22nd, 2015, you guys. So if you live in California, I might be able to fulfill an order if you order from JackieCation.com. If you live in California is what I think. Or maybe you celebrate Armenian Christmas on January 6th. Or maybe you just want this shirt in your life. But know in your hearts that if you order today, it's probably not going to get to you by the 25th, unless you live like a minute away from me. Okay, the credits. Patrick Brady's going to fix this audio. Mike Rickberg, who composed and sang that song that you just heard, he is going to sing again lyrics that he wrote to the Mexican Hat Dance. And Vilmos, he fixes my website, JackieCation.com. How about this? If you want to order things, you can order from JackieCation.com. You can get CDs and DVDs and T-shirts and a hoodie. And all the T-shirts are made here in America, union made, so they run a little big because they're made by Americans. And shipping, I believe, is included with all of that stuff. You can get combos of CDs and the DVD. And the hoodies, I have some in stock. I am out of double X, weirdly enough. Now, you can use the Amazon banner if you want to support the show this month. It's on the main page. It's white on the right-hand side. It says support the show, shop Amazon. It's a portal into Amazon. It doesn't add anything to your order, but when you order through that portal, Dork Forest gets a kickback, and I thank you for it. It is still December, so if you were thinking of donating to the Dork Forest, do not. Donate to a food bank. Find a food bank in your local neighborhood or town or city or state or province or wherever you live. To do that, you know the internet. You can Google the name of the town that you live in and the words food bank, and you will find them. On JackieCation.com, there's a lot of things going on. You can watch videos of my stand-up. You can also see my schedule. In January, I'm all over the place. I'm at Acme in Minneapolis. The first week, I am in Tacoma, Washington. The second week, I'm doing Sketchfest in San Francisco, the third weekend. I'm in Seattle, the fourth weekend. And also that weekend, I'm coming back to L.A. to do a live Dork Forest at the Riot Fest in Los Angeles. So come and see me do stand-up comedy. Check for details at JackieCation.com. But let's get into the show, you guys. Hey, it's Jackie Cation. I am in my living room with a fan favorite, Dork Luminary, Robert Hurt. Remember from the previous episode of the Dork Forest. Welcome back to the show, Robert Hurt.
Jackie, it is always a pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me back.
Super fun. Last year we learned about your job at working with the Spitzer telescope and doing essentially the key, the mapping key color. There was a color visualization. Is that what
the words? Just, data visualization, image visualization, all the visual sides of science communication for
coming from the Spitzer.
Specifically
at that time we were talking.
Yes.
And it's a great episode. It was one of the fan favorites, by the way.
You made the top ten. If you haven't heard it.
That's right. Robert Hurt, by the way, is at Astro Rob on Twitter and astronomyviz.wordpress for your blog and Astro Pics.cool for JPL Spitzer pictures, right?
For all of the NASA missions, for
European
Southern Observatory, astropics.cool is this one sort of catch-all site where we're trying to pull in all of the greatest cool pictures. Imagery from all the key telescopes around the world.
All right.
We still have a few that we're missing, but it's an awesome place to start if you're really looking for the best in astronomy imagery.
Now, we've brought you here today so that we cannot speak of science. We must speak of science fiction.
You can't speak of spaceships. You can't speak science fiction without first speaking science.
Yes, isn't it true? It's so true. So, but you enjoy the spaceships of many a program and movie that has been on the television with the moving pictures.
I do, because yes, once you move past my general science dorkdom, I'd say
because you're an astrophysicist as well as an artist
astrophysicist and an artist, right?
Yeah,
I've done all of this. I started as the artist and the astrophysicist, but if you go back before the art and before the astrophysics, you got to my core geekdom, which anyone who's ever been to my place, which includes you guys.
Yes.
It knows is spaceships.
Andy Ashcraft is silently watching this recording of The Dork Forest because Robert Hurt is one of his oldest friends, and he stares, stares. He will stare politely at us and Andy, possibly laugh.
Andy will be there to correct me if I if I make an erroneous statement.
Swooping in to say, oh, my God. Anyway, but so what was the first spaceship you remember from television and or movies?
I'd say because of my age, the first spaceship that I truly yes. remember, and of course the one that has stuck with me all these years, is of course the USS Enterprise.
Oh,
not,
the first
no
one.
Bloody A, B, C, or D, no. as the engineer Scott commented once on Star Trek Next Generation. Just that original series Enterprise was sort of some of my, you know, my earliest memories goes back to that ship. It was a thing of beauty. I had models of it. My dad made me models. They were destroyed, made more models. They were destroyed. You know, there has always been like multiple Enterprises in my life.
Wow. And what was he making the models out of? Like you would just buy model kits.
Yeah,
and then
AMT.
You would play with them and then they would get destroyed.
Yes.
And then another one would be made and then more glue would be purchased.
Right. As Got we it. Learned, that original Enterprise with those little nacelles and those tiny little pylons, that's not a structurally sound way of attaching warp drives to your secondary hull. We have proven that repeatedly.
We've proven that repeatedly that is not a way to. So what do we know about that ship? Do we know is that ship feasible? Is that ship something? I mean, it would be a terrible idea, the warp.
Oh, well, I mean, that ship is still functions on, magic,
okay. Sure.
You know, the Enterprise certainly falls into the realm of, you know, warp drive. That's the magical physics that we don't know how to do yet. Oh, we'd love to come up with
sure.
it someday, but you know, but
like teleporting.
But it was a really intriguing ship for its time and its design, because the idea to have a starship that had these two little engines that weren't really like thrust coming out of it. The idea is those two engines made a warp field, and that this thing actually travels faster than light because of some, you know, magical gravitational field made around it. And that those engines made it, but they didn't like spew, you know, exhaust out in the process.
Right.
And,
or create radiation that created everyone to die.
Right. And the fact that it wasn't, well.
Were there episodes that explained the warp drive in magical terms?
They explain around it. I mean, there's always a little bit of just referencing it, but it's never really explained because, you know,
dilithium magic. Crystals are clearly involved, right?
Dilithium crystals are clearly involved. Matter and antimatter intermix is involved.
Oh, that's right.
They were forward-looking enough to know that, you know, the most efficient way of getting energy out of a container of fuel is if half the fuel is matter and half is antimatter. And you mix
right.
it and you get lots of energy out. So they were actually
something.
Very cutting-edge physics on that, at least for the source of their power. And
yeah.
then this magical dilithium crystal did something or other to make that
maybe stabilize
work
it or
and
something.
Stabilize
yeah.
it. And then you pump it into the engines and you get warp out of it. So
and you get warp.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And you also get really cool. And I have one quick question that I've always thought about different spaceships forever, which is, why running lights? I mean, is it just so that everyone else on the highway knows that you're there?
Well, you know, it's like you're flying down. If you happen to see this other ship that's like, you know, a light year away, if it doesn't have running lights, how will you ever
You
know?
Might bump into it.
Yes.
You might, you know, are you
I think the running
lane?
Lights are more like when it's in Earth orbit and you're near the space office complex and
right.
the little shuttle pods going around and you happen to be in the shadow of the Earth.
Right.
Then actually having running lights would help you if
right.
your radar isn't working and all of the other technological things that you'd be using to navigate around. You'd still be able to see, oh, yeah, I don't want to bump into that.
Oh, looking out the helicarrier and you're like head toward the water.
Yeah, exactly.
When Nick Fury
right.
says
you know,
that during one of the
Sometimes your
Avengers.
Instruments fail you and you just got to...
You got to look out a window.
Yeah, you got to
And just go, oh,
And
yeah.
a flashy light, man, in the dark, a flashy light. That's all that you're going to see.
That's it. Maybe it'll come up.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
All right. So what... So that's the first and foremost, probably.
So that's the first in my life. But
right.
but to really stretch it back, right, there's been an actually really interesting evolution of spaceships through, you know, the history of science fiction. Now, I'm going to talk mostly like film and TV.
Okay.
And not
yeah, yeah.
so much gaming. There's a whole other branch on gaming stuff, but you know, Warhammer stuff is just butt ugly, so I'm not going to talk about that. But
you don't
know,
like the aesthetics. Fair enough. Fair enough. And are they out in space? I didn't think Warhammer was out in space.
Oh no, yeah. There's whole Warhammer giant, monstrous ships that you know, you can download these ship charts where people have gone through like the whole history of science fiction and tried to put like size comparisons of everything.
Oh right.
It's always the gaming stuff is the stupidly large stuff that makes no sense at all. So
it's like an anime convention and someone's carrying the giantest sword in the whole wide world.
Exactly.
Supposed to fight with that? I know. I get that it looks really, really cool.
Gamers have some sort of inadequacy thing. It always has to be like a big sword, a big ship.
Sure. Who doesn't like a large? Anyway.
But if you go back, if you look at the whole evolution of like the sci-fi spaceship, starship, right? You know, you go back, you know, at the turn of the century, right? And we had the first men on the moon, I forget the French title for it, but right, you know, that was back basically projectiles. You like fire things out of cannons.
Oh, right. It looked more like a bullet
or the movie Things to Come. Again, very, very early 1930-ish something sci-fi, right? You know, giant cannons that blasted things because we hadn't gotten to the idea of like putting engines on our stuff yet.
Right. It was all being propelled.
Right. Then you get into like the 30s and 40s, and then it was all like the serials, Flash Gordon. And Buck Rogers, and then those were like the spark driven ships, right? Those were like they'd make these little model sleds hung on wires, and they'd have sparklers in the back that would shoot smoke and sparks, and they would drag those around the set, and they were I was digging for like a design sense of what characterized those ships, and you know I'm actually. That was whatever they could build roughly a set shape for. And so the ship's kind of like roughly like cylindrical.
Do they look like cars or?
They look like cars. Well, you know, if you actually run it across to the 1970s in the movie Flesh Gordon, that was the parody of all the Flash Gordon, they really took that shape to its ultimate conclusion to its
Flesh
ultimate...
Gordon? Was it a little bit of possibly a dick joke?
It was phallic. And
Yes, there you go.
Let's face it, that's what they are, little flying penises with sparks coming out the back. Because,
which is actually how penises work. Kids, if you're listening, that's how penises work. They have sparklers coming out of them. It's one of the greatest things in the world.
You better put the explicit tag on this podcast.
Exactly.
For your innocent
gentleman. Yes. It's all right. But, nobody's listening.
But after that, right, we get through a period, then you know, we have the World War II, then we import all the German scientists over after World War II, and we have Wernher von Braun, who comes, you know, and worked on the V2 program, but then comes over and
that's right. We did I did a thing just entirely about actual rockets with a woman who goes by at Vintage Space. Mm. And she was, I had forgotten what regular real rockets essentially they were Nazi scientists that we split them up with the Soviet Union or something. And we got that guy
Wernher von Braun.
Right. And so they were very phallic.
Very phallic,
and
but
super
also very
tall.
Smooth and curvy and voluptuous. I mean, you know, you look at the V2, and if you forget for a moment about it being a weapon of mass destruction, this beautiful, elegant, simple, clean lines with fins.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that design aesthetic came as he was working in the U.S. and they were really trying to project the future of the space program. Mm-hmm. And this idea of this smooth, clean line future really, really took hold. And so you've got like the generation of movies of like in the 50s of Destination Moon and Rocket Ship XM that she can tell.
Yeah,
By the way, I made notes for this. So I'm sure I get the years right.
Yeah, yeah.
I can remember the movies. I can never remember the years. So
Fair enough.
I did a little research just to make sure I got those numbers.
Otherwise. It's just people shouting at their iPods because they have access to their computers.
Exactly.
So we appreciate it.
Oh, of course. You know. And so there is this that was that beautiful retro future of clean, smooth lines. And this is kind of a continuation of the Buck Rogers trend.
And fins and everything, too.
Fins and aerodynamic and smooth and everything. But it was also in the 50s we got our first new, like completely new, like species of spaceship, right? And this dates back to 1947. A pilot, pilot by the name, what was this guy's name? I was trying to remember his numbers. Yes. Kenneth Arnold was a pilot who was flying near Mount Rainier and reported seeing a formation of saucer-shaped objects skipping along, like they were skipping along, like you might skip
like
a saucer off the water.
Like throwing stones.
Right, like throwing stones, but like in a saucer shape. And this report captured the imagination, and that was the genesis of flying saucers. After that report and it getting all this press, all of a sudden flying saucers were seen everywhere. And, of course, that was 1947, so by the 1950s, flying saucers worked their way into all the popular
they
media.
They were real.
They were real. Yeah. So they, you know, that's when you started getting movies like Earth versus the Flying Saucers, for one, or The Day the Earth Stood Still, you know, and it's sort of two extremes.
Is one, The Day the Earth Stood Still the one with the giant statue robot guy?
Yes, Gort.
Okay. Gort.
Klaatu Barada Nikto. Robert Wise directed, actually. So you have Earth versus Flying Saucers, which is just your cheesy invasion movie with beautiful Ray Harryhausen stop motion effects, whereas Earth versus Flying Saucers is a very thoughtful metaphor for the Cold War
the robot one?
The robot one, yes. It was very serious. It was one of the first real...
The Day the Earth Stood Still?
Day the Earth Stood Still.
There we
still
go.
Stands up today.
Okay.
And
I think
forget.
I've seen most of it.
And never forget, Klaatu Barada Nikto, or we're all screwed.
Well, note to self.
Yeah.
And spice.
And so, flying saucers invaded for a while. And like This Island Earth, another kind of semi-serious sci-fi movie of aliens.
Do you have a favorite flying saucer?
Yes, I do. And that was actually also in the 50s, but later in the 50s, the movie Forbidden Planet.
Okay.
Made another first in history because that was the first time that humans, we were shown to be the pilots of flying saucers. And again, Forbidden Planet, a fantastic movie, a very thoughtful, very intellectual film.
Like the best science fiction is.
Like the best science fiction is. You know, the their flying saucer was the C-57D.
Oh, was
nice
it?
Serial number.
Excellent,
you know,
very nice.
Beautiful, elegant, simple, but... You know, when its landing sequence came in, it would like emit this little glowy cylinder of light that it sort of bounced and floated down gently to a landing.
Nice.
And, you know, a nice triaxial symmetry little landing legs came down. And
yeah.
Same movie that introduces to Robbie the Robot, you know, a famous robot that's, you know, persisted for years through cinema.
Oh, right.
Later in Lost in Space and things.
Okay.
But yeah, but that was the first time... You know, humans got put into the cockpit of the flying saucer then. And then, then there's a little bit of history of that going on, you know.
Right.
Let's see, any other good flying saucer movies? Oh, of course, there's also the famous Plan 9 from Outer Space, you know.
And, oh, right. That
which
thing.
The flying saucers there were actually, a Revell model kit that came out of a flying saucer, and that was their symbol.
Sure, that guy was on a budget, if I remember correctly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And So
the 50s basically gave us the smooth, clean line ships and the flying saucers.
Okay.
But... The 60s is really, again, the next landmark change, I think.
We have a call from the peanut gallery. Yes, Andy, would you like to pipe in? Come on in.
So before we leave the 50s, I want to talk about industrial design in the 50s as well, because that's when you also saw those sort of sleek lines in cars. And it's because the 50s was the first time that they were able to easily mass produce complex curves.
Oh.
That is hot.
Thank you.
That's because the cars, you think of the really high-end cars, all these luxurious, complex curves.
Jet age sort of look.
The jet age.
There we go.
It was all about being able to create those complex curves.
All right, then. So they finally were able to do that.
Whatever looks hot in the car is then... What
turned
looks
into
hot,
a spaceship.
That's the thing that looks stylish and future.
Did
always...
that happen in the 60s too?
So in the 60s, really what happens is the movie, I think, that sort of changed everything in design, set us on a whole new path, it was the antithesis of the small, the clean line, smooth design, and that was 2001.
Did that come out in the 60s?
That came out in the 60s, 1967, I think, 68.
Was that before or after Star Trek?
That was actually the year after Star Trek.
Okay.
So Star Trek predated. And Star Trek still had, you know, the Enterprise, very smooth, clean lines.
Oh, it had a flying saucer with a couple of...
Right. So Star Trek was kind of this weird little hybrid because, you know, there's that tradition of the flying saucer.
Yeah.
But they really wanted this design to be like more of a starship, and this idea of there would be a warp engine and this whole other thing. So they sort of split the difference. You got the flying saucer in front, but then they attached it to a much larger...
A couple of giant exhaust things, but that didn't actually give exhaust, as we already discussed.
Right.
But they look like giant sort of exhaust tubes coming out of the back of a 50s car.
And then
if
the
you
other,
thought about it.
And the other striking thing, exactly. It had a little bit of that kind of high end, like fins on the back of the car
fins
feel
and jacked.
To it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, but you know, absolutely, you have to pay reference to Matt Jeffries, who's the designer of
okay.
the Enterprise. And, you know, just the early sketches he went through and all the permutations that finally led to this dual nacelle design. And the fact that has propagated forward through the whole history of Star Trek ever since is just one of the most fundamental, like, design elements that we've never
it
left.
Really,
and
stuck.
We continue to play with variants on that theme over and over again.
Right.
But yeah, so you sort of had Star Trek fitting in that smooth, clean line legacy. Oh, and then, you know, the Klingon ship, again, very smooth lines to it.
Was it a warbird?
The warbird was the
Star Trek?
The Romulans.
Oh, okay.
By the warbirds. Okay. And, but then the Romulan ship also, which, again, had a very smooth, clean, simple geometry to it. Beautiful bird of prey painted on the bottom. But again, this is still that era of smoothness, right?
Right.
In the midst of all this, you have Kubrick pairing up with Arthur C. Clarke to tell like a sort of a nitty-gritty science fiction story, but rooted in reality. And of course, one of the major revelations they had in terms of design there was that if you're in space, you don't have atmosphere. You don't have to worry about drag or friction or smooth or streamline.
Oh.
None of that matters, right? If you're
okay.
in space. So 2001 really introduced us to the idea of the complex, weird, unwieldy, completely non-aerodynamic structure.
What did it look like? I've never seen 2001, which of course is something not to be said out loud.
I'm not going to be the film critic who harangues you for it.
Think of the great day when I do get to see it.
Yes,
that's
true.
What we could do. We could look forward to that day.
Well, I mean, 2001 actually gave us a whole bunch of things. They gave us a circular space station that was only partially constructed, that rotated
interesting.
Let the centrifugal force give you gravity. I mean, the same things that came from, you know, the Wernher von Braun tradition,
mm-hmm.
conquest of space ideas in the 50s that, you know, we were looking at. How would you, you know, if you, you
how would
to,
it really,
how would you really be able to build something like that? And we know that, like, if you've ever ridden the centrifuge at the park, right, it feels like gravity, right?
Yeah.
So you could do this. So they showed us the space station. They gave us the Pan Am Space Clipper, which was a very streamlined kind of predecessor design to the shuttle, which
okay.
is very prescient. It was the Pan Am Space Clipper, which was not very prescient since Pan Am didn't survive
right.
the year 2001. As it
made a hell of a handbag, though.
Yeah,
anyway,
but made
keep
a hell
going.
Of a handbag, yeah. Uh-huh. But then you have like this big spherical clunky thing they use to get from the space station to the lunar base.
Okay.
And then from there, they mount the Discovery, the giant ship that's designed to spend a couple of years taking us out from the moon to Jupiter.
Okay.
Very long term. It requires some hibernation of the astronauts. And that's a big long. So the Discovery basically is like a big ball on the end, the sphere.
Okay.
And has some docking ports. And there's supposed to be a centrifuge in the sort of middle part of that sphere is a very long neck with a communications array and then separating it from a big engine component at the back.
Oh, okay.
It's all very, you know.
Oh, it looks like sort of a bobbing bird?
Yeah,
that thing,
sure.
That thing that you balance and if you move it, it can dip into the water?
Yeah, I think of
okay.
it like a 20-foot long bobbing bird that's then covered with bits of pieces of tanks and aircraft carrier model kit bits that are just glued all over it to give it all this texture, fine little niggly details.
Oh, cool.
And so that was this idea where we really moved from this beautiful, smooth streamline to this that just cram all this little detail. And literally, they would do this. They would kit bash. They would buy model kits and just grab like the little turrets and guns and just stick little stuff so you have texture all over the surface.
Okay.
And then that really changed like Starship design from there on because, you know, all
it could
of a sudden,
be anything.
Now
then.
It could be anything, not just these smooth lines.
Yeah.
So that was sort of happened alongside Star Trek, but then that really kind of kicked us off this entire new design motif that
right.
really stuck around, you know, ever since.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but yeah, of course, the other one I have to left out, of course, the other thing that we had in TV that actually predated Star Trek by a year was Lost in Space.
Oh, yeah.
And of course.
How did they get there?
Yeah,
what did their ship look like?
They flew in a flying saucer.
Okay.
So they were still in the flying saucer tradition.
Okay.
Know,
and they were just Gilligan's Island in space, right?
They were Gilligan's Island in space.
Okay.
That was silly sci-fi. Star Trek came on to show serious sci-fi.
Right.
2001.
Got
super sci-fi.
Serious. Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, it was just like kind of year after year, you saw this evolution from silly to serious to like art form.
Right, right.
And that kind of kicked things off and shifted things in the future.
Ooh, what was the spaceship they used in Planet of the Apes?
So the Planet of the Apes, they were on a budget, so when that spaceship crashed, all we ever got to see was the nose cone sticking out of the water.
That's
And it was it was very smooth. It was very pointy,
it was very rockety looking.
Yeah, it was very rockety, but also had kind of an atmospheric entry. You know, you want that to be smooth. It had a couple of fins. But you know, I, as a kid, I always felt stupidly cheated because I wanted to see what the rest of the ship looked like. Screw the apes. Screw Charlton Heston. Show me more of that ship. It looked cool, but I only saw a little piece of it.
Right, right. Fair enough. Wow. Yeah, they didn't have the budget, I guess, right?
They did not have the budget.
Fair enough.
So, yeah, that was always... And unfortunately, the 70s, after this kind of burst of activity in the 60s and TV shows and stuff, 70s was a pretty dry period for spaceships, for at least the first half of it, right?
Wait.
The early 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
Not much going on. I mean, we had Silent Running... kind of artsy Bruce Dern starring movie.
Okay.
With, you know, very, it was
crazy
ecological stuff in space, but beautiful, beautiful ship, the Valley Forge. Again, very, very, it was Doug Trumbull who worked on 2001, on Silent Running. You had basically these were sort of aggro ships with these domes that had, the last forests of Earth left, and they were inside these sort of geodesic domes.
Okay.
You know, Buckminster Fuller in the 60s, the geodesic dome was popularized, so they used that design for these domes on the ship.
Outside of the Wisconsin Dells in Wisconsin, there used to be the Foam House of Tomorrow, and it was a geodesic dome that sadly lasted far too long, and then they eventually put it away, and then everyone was like, oh man, now it would be hilarious. They lasted just long enough, and then they took it away, and everyone was like, now it's ironic. Where is it? And they're like, well, we destroyed it because it was dumb. And
it would have lasted. That's it they were very durable, right?
Yeah,
the geodesic. That was the, but, you know, so the Valley Forge was this clump of geodesic domes on one end and a big framework that connected to an engine in the back. Again, kind of echoing the discovery.
Yeah.
Completely non-aerodynamic. It was
Valley
actually
Valley Forge is a great name for a spaceship.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It was near the orbit of Saturn. And, of course, the stupidity of the movie or the stupidity of humanity being depicted is that we didn't have room left for forests on Earth, so we just made these ships to just like a seed banks of like the last bit of plant life on our planet that we had pretty much wiped out. And
right. Not no one thinking, guess what? This ecosystem doesn't exist anywhere else. Why are we saving just the ecosystem? That's weird. Okay. Yeah, that is a weird. There's a reason I've never heard of that movie.
Yeah.
Fair enough.
And
but then
in that era, also early 70s, we had a British show called UFO, or I should say, it proper British, UFO.
Okay.
They always pronounced it. This was done by Jerry Anderson, who was the same guy who brought you, if you remember, the puppet shows, Thunderbirds,
Captain
Scarlet. That was like the late 60s.
Okay.
It was his first live action show. And it was this delightfully grim, incredibly boring one season series about the futuristic 1980s when there's a secret UFO invasion of Earth where these UFOs are coming to Earth in the desolate little places off in the you know farmlands and kidnapping humans and harvesting their organs and shipping them back to their planet because apparently everyone's dying
that
of
got
organ
co-opted
failure.
Into society even though nobody saw that TV show.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because there's a lot of organ harvesting that people think is happening.
Yep.
Which, yeah. Yeah,
it was very cutting edge in that thing.
That was
and there was actually
edge.
A lot of kind of cutting edge ideas in that show. You know, the depiction of interracial romance without batting an eye.
Right.
Women who are in positions of authority. The entire moon base was largely staffed by a female crew that commanded by a woman. You know, things that, you know, this was 1972. This was, you know, just a few years after NBC almost didn't let Gene Roddenberry have a woman, much less a black woman, even sit on the bridge of the Enterprise.
Wow.
And at in UFO, you actually have moon base commanded by women.
Yeah.
And the all commands. So, yeah, some cool stuff there. The spaceships there were, you know, of course, the UFOs. That there were nice spinny alien things. That,
sure.
And you had these lovely moon base interceptors that would launch off of. This was the Jerry Anders thing. You had these craters that would slide open, little openings, and elevators would lift them up into the craters, and they would lift off from there and launch little nuclear missiles off their tip and then fly back because they were really – one-shot things.
Oh, kinda fair enough.
You know,
need
guys
to go get
on a Saturday night, you know.
Needed to be reloaded.
Needed to be reloaded, yeah.
I see what you did there.
Refractory period was you know, at least 6 hours, I think, for them. So,
yes.
But my favorite, and that wasn't technically a spaceship. It was a submarine. It was called Skydiver. And it was a beautiful sub, but it would, like, tilt up and its nose cone would launch off underwater and burst out of the water and become a little jet fighter that would then shoot UFOs down out of the sky.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. So, yeah, that's good times.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's my honorary spaceship.
From the water.
But
yes.
From the water, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, but all ships can be kind of cool.
And subs are just like spaceships underwater, honestly.
They really are. I mean, we've had more subs than we've had spaceships.
Yeah.
And so that's where people who make spaceships really get to use their real artistic chops.
But then, by the time we get to the late 70s, now things start changing and it becomes the glory day for spaceships again. Now, again, the first thing I'm going to reference, though, you won't think of, it's actually not that movie franchise. We're coming to that, but not
okay, because that's the only thing before I know about the 70s.
Before that, something of great significance, Gerry Anderson's next TV series, now surviving a full two seasons, Space 1999.
Oh, weird. I do remember that.
Yeah. Now, this was a little further casting. The plot of that was basically that the nuclear waste dump that we have on the moon, because, of course, we were going to have an entire lunar colony by 1999,
right.
And
mm-hmm.
that's where we would ship all our nuclear waste, somehow ignites and becomes like a big jet engine that propels the moon out of Earth's orbit, rocketing it through space and into a new solar system every week. And won't focus.
That only lasted two seasons?
Only lasted two seasons.
I can't say I'm shocked.
Yeah.
Wow, that guy knows how to pitch a show, though, doesn't he?
It does. It's pretty crazy ambitious.
Space 1999 was about the moon that would go into a new solar system every episode?
Week. Yeah, pretty much.
Holy, there's a... Yeah, I think we watched Doctor Who during that time.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
It was, well, of course, Doctor Who was on. This whole period too.
Right, right. But that was just a phone booth.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Anyway, so I get that.
Phone booth.
A very cool phone booth, you guys.
But Space 1999, one of the things they really focused on were these beautiful, traditional visual effects, just classic in-camera stuff.
Okay.
They would literally hang things from wires and film them against just black backgrounds and then double expose stars in to get the backgrounds in. And so if you watch like the shots from the show, you'll actually notice like if the ships were flying in a particular path, you would notice there would be stars above and below that path, but not actually in it. Because
right.
they couldn't afford complex optical printing. They just had to like double expose
right.
like, stars and every now and then you actually see it fly over a star and you suddenly realize it's transparent. It's
right.
mostly.
Yeah.
But Space 1999 is important because it built on the tradition of 2001 and it gave what I think is one of my favorite ships of all time. We've already hit the Enterprise, which is definitely my favorite capital ship of starship of all time.
Fair enough.
Space 1999 gave me one of the most beautiful transport vessels of all time, the Eagle. Transporter. It was this modular ship that would be their sort of their workhorse ship on the moon.
Okay.
It had a nice little rounded forward pod for the module for the crew or the pilot.
Okay.
Then you had this nice little four landing legs, and then you had this crew module that was detachable. And they could swap in mission modules for different purposes. Your Eagles had one module for transporting nuclear waste to the dump site, had another module for carrying
people. Yeah.
They actually had a specially painted module for VIPs. They got an orange module.
Right.
Another one for rescue purposes that had red stripes on it. Had another one that was like an extra large area that had like sensors in it.
Is there an action figure of that? Because that they're missing out on
the
series.
There was British Dinky Toys back in the 70s made various
because
versions
to
of them.
Have swappable. Expansion.
Since
options.
Then, there's a company that in the last 10 years made like basically all the variants of the Eagle, and I have them all in my living room. And
congratulations.
All the modules that,
sure.
that it was like, it's just, it's this thing that you look at. It's a thing of beauty. I actually have like a 22 inch model in my living room that's studio scale for one of the shooting mods.
Oh, cool.
They did. It was like, just, but it's still, you look at this today after all these years and you think, yeah, that would fly.
Oh, cool.
It has this just elegant, but beautiful, like, utility to it. The modularity, very nice touch. So,
and a nice touch. Wow.
And so that tied us over until we finally got to...
Dun, dun,
dun. Or dun, 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 Star Wars.
Star Wars. I saw that movie.
Yeah.
That was one of the...
A few people... It's got
legs.
It turned a profit.
I think it turned a profit.
Yeah.
We're recording this a week before it comes out, just so you know.
Oh, yes.
And neither of us have cancer. So we have not seen it.
Yeah.
And
I know that I'm not going to see it opening night, just because I think it'll still be out when I come home.
Yeah, I'm actually I couldn't get my shit together and get my tickets. You know,
oh, is it sold out?
2.5 months in advance for opening night. So yeah.
Oh my gosh! We'll, all right,
have to.
It'll all work out. I think it'll still be airing.
Yeah.
So.
But Star Wars brought a bunch of new design elements to the thing. Well, first of all, it continues that tradition, the 2001 tradition of sort of the kitbash design of lots of little nurbly bits all over.
Yeah, yeah.
Raid the model
like that
stores.
Giant, the pointy one.
Right, the pointy one. The Star Destroyer, you know, wedge shaped, giant, massive ship. But if you look at it, there's like this incredible detail at all levels. These are these beautiful, like 10-foot long models they would build, and they would just paste little bits of anything they could pull out of model kit boxes.
Yeah.
And it would have this incredible texture. But a couple things that Star Wars brought, in addition to that tradition continuing it, was the introduction of fighter craft into sci-fi. Because we had never really seen...
Oh, short-range fighter
craft. Short-range, you know, just small, single-pilot vessels.
Giant vessels that would shoot at each other.
Right.
Like ships, like broadsiding.
Yeah. You know, there was nothing more boring than a Star Trek original series ship battle.
It's true. It was pretty lame.
Yeah, just it was sit not and any... fire, and you sort of had
right.
the same
it was fine.
Shot, right?
But there better be some dialogue,
right?
Because
right.
it's just about a shaking chairs.
Yes,
and then.
But you know, Lucas was highly inspired by World War II dogfighting sequences, and so he wanted to put that into space. And
right.
So that brought up the idea of the individual fighters and swarms of them in these you know big action sequences. It was truly unlike anything we'd seen at that point.
Yeah, just X fighters and
X-wings. Y-wings versus the TIE fighters.
My Star Wars is. Here's what I will admit about Star Wars, you guys. I love it. I don't know the names of all the toys. So I don't know the names of all the robots. I don't know the names of all the ships. I get to just like it. And safe space. So there you go.
Safe space. No, you absolutely get to do that.
But the X-Wing, those were my favorites.
So the X-Wing brought yet another innovation we hadn't really seen in movies before. And this is the idea of moving parts.
Yeah.
Ships.
Oh, I right.
We see maybe a little rotating, radar towers and things.
Right.
But the X-Wing, everyone like just freaked out when they're flying on their attack vector, and all of a sudden their wings opened up into an attack configuration.
Yeah.
And that was like this whole new thing. We just didn't see this before.
And then each spike has, it's like flying a dragonfly or flying a mosquito.
Turbo laser on each wing. So you have four turbo, they alternate back and forth, but that added this whole new kind of coolness. Like, oh yeah, they can actually move around. Interestingly, not something that got picked up again for a long time, basically.
Yeah.
They staked out that space, but it wasn't for another like 20 years before we really started to see a return to that.
Other people
concept.
Using it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, and then Millennium Falcon, of course.
And then the Millennium Falcon, again, sort of beautiful, just stunningly beautiful kitbash design.
Yeah.
But Millennium Falcon brought yet another interesting element to it. And this is this idea of this integrated set design that matches the ship design. So that when you look at the set and then you look at the ship, you go, oh, I know where that corridor is. And, you know, like Star Trek did that a little bit in the sense that the bridge was at the top. And so you sort of saw that and that was supposed to be where the bridge is. And a couple shots let you peek in the window at the top of the bridge. And kind of clumsy, but they started to do that. Star Wars, you know, the Millennium Falcon, like that little corridor you run through to get to the cockpit. It's actually a corridor. Or it's a tube.
It looks like, yeah.
And so the idea that, oh, you know, we can actually design our ships and with our sets and make it so they all fit together.
And so everybody has a real sense of how their toy would or how it would actually look.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
And then that tradition actually was picked up a couple of years later when, of course, Star Trek finally returned after a long hiatus in Star Trek the Motion Picture.
Right.
And Doug Trumbull, again, carrying through from taking over the visual effects and really wanting to lovingly again show these massive scale ships, working with the designer Andy Probert, who did the redesign of the Enterprise, taking that beautiful Matt Jeffries look from the late 60s, but needing to scale it up at this incredible resolution to fit on a movie screen.
Okay.
And so that actually is the one I point out as my favorite Enterprise is that redesign that came out in Star Trek The Motion Picture. Because it took all of the elements, all the design, all the proportions from the original show,
yeah,
but just gave it this extra polish and elegance and beauty to it. And
I don't know that I've seen The Motion Picture again.
Well, it's the same design that shows up in all of the Kirk Spock movies. So
okay.
All through Star Trek VI, you see that design over
okay.
and over again. It's
yeah.
that same one.
Okay.
Instead of tubes for nacelles, they're actually sort of flattened.
Okay.
But the other thing is, they worked really hard again on the set design to make those sets fit into areas of the ship and, window designs that were mimicked on the inside and outside.
Yeah.
Things you didn't fully appreciate till they actually remastered that digitally in the
15
years ago,
yeah.
the late 90s, where they sort of finished some of the visual effects they didn't do. And really, you got that sense of geography on the ship when you look out a window and you see a nacelle out there. Some
yeah.
really nice things.
Yeah,
so,
those were really cool.
And so it was just a beautiful switch to that. And then, of course, on the heels of that, we get Battlestar Galactica, sci-fi on TV again. That was like the late 70s.
The old Battlestar Galactica.
The old Battlestar, right. And again, the beautiful giant Battlestar, huge kind of kitbash design, lovely structure, lots of fiddly detail.
Yeah.
But then bringing the fighter jets, but then into TV mode instead of in movie mode. And so it was really our first sort of TV space battle things.
They look like sparrows, didn't they? The jets on
Battlestar?
Yeah,
the Vipers, actually. They
were the Vipers?
Called.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, and sort of...
But they the wings were kind of closer.
Yeah,
and
stubby
kinda,
little close-in wings,
yeah.
right. You know, nice tight jets. But again, it had a nice utilitarian kind of...
They look like jets.
Jet look to it,
super
yeah.
jets, yeah. But
and
clearly...
capable of atmospheric and
right,
space. You know,
space
so they were
capable.
Kind of splitting the difference there.
That's what you want.
So, yeah. Cylons, our robotic overlords.
Right. Who were not Daleks. The Cylons, what did they look like? Were they tall robot guys?
Silvery robot with a big red eye.
Oh, that's right.
Robotic by your command, which for the life of me sounded like the warnings, audio warnings you got at the Atlanta airport for like at least 20 years, which sadly I think have turned to a more human sound at this point. But yeah, it was really the same kind of sound. And the big Cylon base stars, which are sort of big flying saucery things, but
they were bases or...
Giant space bases, you know.
Okay.
And, you know, the Battlestar Galactica, again, a giant ship, you know, capable of, you know, probably thousands of people could fit in, you know, whole landing bays, you know. They had, like, you know, a modern-day aircraft carrier has one giant surface, and that's where the things land. On the Battlestar, the landing bays were just small parts of the whole ship, so.
Oh, wow. And they were all the size of... each of those or
yeah,
whatever.
Neat little launching, shooting out the side of the landing bay.
Yeah, little tubes.
Little tubes
to
shot out
to...
of. Yeah, so mm-hmm. a lot of cool designs there. Oh, but I did one other thing I left out of the 70s, though, before we forget. It actually fits right into Star Wars, is Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Oh, we're back to saucers.
We're back to saucers, but not saucers. Like, Close Encounters changed our view of UFOs and alien UFOs from just these solid, shiny saucers to ships built out of light. They actually would build all these fanciful designs and illuminate them with colored lights, and they actually shot them in smoky rooms. So you got all this beautiful light filtering, streaming out.
Oh,
and
wow.
then, so all of the ships, you never even got a good look. All you saw
yeah.
was the glow from them. And then of course, the final mothership, again, one of the most beautifully, artfully beautiful designs of ships in science fiction, shows up. And it's this mix of this nerdly, super detailed, spire-covered, you know, sort of inspired by like Palos Verdes and the oil refineries at night.
Okay.
That area, you know, South Bay, and with all the light filtering out through the smoky. And so it's a mixture of just the how it looks with light and structure intertwined.
Yeah.
Again, gave us another beautiful, beautiful motif that...
So does it look sort of like... I can't even picture it. Is it like a cityscape kind of
yeah,
thing?
Yeah, so there's a giant dome on one side.
Okay.
And then around underneath the dome, there are like spires sticking out in all directions radially with like lights at the end of the spires.
Oh, okay.
And under that middle section, there are a series of like tubes sticking, blue tubes lit from the inside, light shining out. And so just, it really is, if you go by like a giant oil refinery, it has that look to it. It's
cool.
Quite well inspired.
Yeah, that and that was in the 70s as well, right? Close
yeah.
Encounters?
That was in the 70s as well, yeah.
Okay. What about that shark in Jaws? Is that a spaceship? That is not.
It's animatronic, but it's not a spaceship.
Right.
It did have
right.
moving parts, though.
It did have moving parts.
Before
I saw it on
the
tour.
Even yeah.
before the... Because it was broken and it was backing up. And as we all know, sharks can't go backwards. And... And then the phone rang. So Andy's just going to hang up on it. Good for him. And
priorities, man. Priorities.
That's it's a classic. So
that brings us to the 80s.
To the 80s.
Yeah. And the 80s saw some interesting things. For instance, one movie way ahead of its time, really probably the most significant change in ship design and ship realization in movies, started in the 80s, but really didn't take hold for another decade.
Okay.
And that was the movie The Last Starfighter.
Oh, and 1982 or 83, right?
Yeah, yeah, the so early mid-80s.
And I own The Last Starfighter, and I have watched it because of Robert Preston.
Oh, yeah, right.
That's why you want to watch The Last Starfighter.
But The Last Starfighter is noteworthy because that was the first ever use of a CG, computer-generated model ship, as the way of rendering the visual effects in the movie.
Oh.
And
it was a triangle
stupidly
ship.
Stupidly primitive by modern standards. Like,
sure.
Right. It
first
looked
time.
Computery.
Yeah.
But it was the first time. And
yeah.
It established an ability to show things like, you know, huge arrays of things spread out through space, which you can compute mathematically, but you'd never be able to build models of.
Right.
And so, you know, they were showing, giving us a hint of what was going to come, but it really did take the technology like a decade to catch up to our desires of what we wanted to show.
A classic. It's a classic thing
with
art, just getting a little bit ahead of what can be really done.
Exactly, exactly.
Was Red Dwarf in the 80s?
Red Dwarf, I think, was in the 80s, yes. The British series.
Yeah, the British series that had...
And continued through the 90s. And
I don't think they ever
kinda
showed the outside of that ship, though.
They did, actually. It was
did
the
they?
Credits. And it, just this big, monstrous red ship. Yeah, because in the opening credits, it shows them like trying to whitewash or clean the right around the paint job where it says Red Dwarf, and then the camera like pulls back and it reveals
oh, and then it's a giant, yes, okay, I remember,
city in space kind of thing,
right? Because a Red Dwarf is an actual term, is it not? Isn't it a star?
It's a type of star.
There we go. I'll be over here knowing some science, but not enough.
Exactly.
So that'll be fine.
Then of course the another big design thing that we sort of really saw from the first times in the 80s was in the movie The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai, Beyond the Eighth Dimension.
Oh, and what was that ship like?
So that was when the red Lectroids from the ninth dimension? Yeah, I forget. One of those higher dimensional species.
Sure.
The ship they built was like organic. It was gooey. It was sloppy. It was wet. It was grown.
Oh.
And the design of the ship is actually based very much on the design of a seashell, a particular spiky conch shell kind of creature. I don't know the exact species.
Yeah.
I actually happen to have one at
home. Anemone, maybe?
No, it's just like the classic like spirally shell thing. But
oh, okay.
It's like you actually look at it and you realize they totally took that and they just added more curves and things and stuck a couple engines in back. And they gave a very organic, mushy kind of spaceship.
And it wasn't, but it wasn't a mushy, was it alive?
It was alive, yeah. It was
the Buckaroo Banzai spaceship was alive?
Yeah, it was clearly the idea of a grown organism that was capable of space flight, rather than
that people could fly in.
That people could fly in.
Huh.
Yeah.
How did it work? I don't remember.
They never
that.
Went into that level of detail.
Fair enough.
Yeah,
Fair enough. There was no magical explanation.
Yeah, it was not necessary.
It was not necessary.
It was
clearly some sort of symbiotic relationship between them and their spaceship. It was just weird and alien and allowed to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. What was next?
And, of course, then what really happened and really hit at the end of the 80s, Star
yes.
Trek, The Next Generation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so now we finally move into a weekly return to Star Trek and
mm-hmm.
a redesign of the Enterprise, casting it forward in time, another 75 years or so. And again, Andy Probert, who did the same design from the original refit
movies.
Enterprise
yeah.
the movies, did the design of the Enterprise D. We actually skipped, you know, A, B, C, and then we got to the D.
Right, so that they could go do prequels if they needed to.
Exactly. And again, continued this tradition of the saucer and this very smooth, curvy, contoury shape to
it. It's because it's a more peaceful time.
It's a more peaceful time.
And
much
it's
a larger vessel, over a thousand people on,
right.
A city in space kind
mm-hmm.
of idea. A much flatter design. It was also moved towards the original Enterprise has a lot of height to it.
It was tall.
It's tall. And we start to see this idea of these capital ships being squashed and becoming much flatter, mm-hmm. Starting in the late 80s. And the tradition really carries through to today, through Star Trek in particular.
Which feels aerodynamic in a place that doesn't need to be, but yeah. It does still look cool.
But I think it speaks, I always liked this idea of these smooth, elegant, complex curvature shapes in Star Trek, because I thought it spoke to a society that designs ships not just to function well, but to look beautiful, that aesthetic is actually as important as functionality, or at least
it makes sense in their society. Because
an ideal society, one where it's really living in a virtual paradise, largely.
Right.
You know, why not make your day-to-day technology also pleasurable?
Right. Very beautiful.
I like to think that Starfleet design actually came, you know, from a lineage that you can trace back to Johnny Ives and Apple. You know.
Fair enough. Just because. That's Robert Hurt, by the way. Robert Hurt, pro-Apple for many years. You were in the ground floor of Apple, weren't you?
The entire bridge of the Enterprise D was in giant iPads. You know,
right, it is all iPads.
All these digital touch screens, right? You know, so it's a...
Let me remind people, by the way, it's at AstroRob on Twitter and AstronomyViz, V-I-Z, .wordpress or on WordPress, and then AstroPix.cool for real space pictures, AstroPix.cool, P-I-X.
Yep.
Okay, so we're Next Generation, which I always called Next Trek, but other people call TNG now.
TNG, yeah, you got to get the original series is TOS, the original
right.
series. The animated series that was in the 70s, actually.
Right.
I didn't touch on that, but, you know, there was an animated. That's TAS.
Right, because it was animated.
TNG, right.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm. Yep.
And then, of course, coming up after TNG was...
DS9.
Deep Space Nine.
Oh, Deep Space Nine.
So, yeah, we really like those three-letter acronyms for our Star Trek.
Sure. And Next Trek, which I will call until I die, because it was the Next Trek, that's what we called it in my family. And and so we would watch it every Sunday night. We would, like, The Power of the Sun, and we were all drawn to the television. And DS9 was harder for me, because they never left anywhere.
Well, they did eventually. They got their beautiful little Defiant.
That's it, the Defiant. That little fist of a spaceship that went out and punched people in the face.
Yep, yep.
So.
But TNG is responsible, and the extended, you know, from TNG to DS9 to Voyager. One of the things that I have to comment there is one of the things it brought was simply, and now I switch to the visual aids I brought, which sadly those listening cannot actually see.
Oh, Andy's going to take pictures, but you don't have to take them now.
There is a...
We're not live, but I appreciate it.
The sheer volume of ship design that occurred because of the Star Trek series is almost unspeakable. I hold before Jackie and Andy a collection of numbered magazines, up to 55 currently. This is the Eagle Moss Starship collection. Every fortnight... if you're British, every fortnight... Every 2 weeks.
You get a magazine...
and a model of that ship. So I have been subscribed.
It's a Star Trek.
It's a Star Trek model ship collecting monthly.
Magazine monthly. It comes twice a month.
Well, actually, once a month I get two.
Once a month you get two. And how long have you been getting these?
I signed up at the Star Trek Vegas convention about 2.5 years ago.
Okay. Okay. So
now,
not the last 30 years ago.
This is my dining room table. This is where my dorkdom really comes out. I'm admitting.
Can I have one copy?
Hey,
just to hold. Take an entire stack of them.
Take a stack, right?
Hello, America. Rangers. We are deep in the dark forest right now, and it is a beautiful thing. Eagle Moss Collections presents Star Trek, the official Starships collection. And this is a Vulcan Dekir-type... Dekir?
Cruiser, yes. Dekir? That was actually Star Trek Enterprise. Showed us some of the beautiful, lovely Vulcan designs.
The art on this is amazing.
And, and so in addition to each month getting, like... and I swear I'm not being paid to represent them. I'm just saying this is a really
well,
dorky thing
God.
That I do.
Yes.
You get not only the model, but you get the magazine that tells you, like, how
you get
the
a model
design...
to make?
You see the design process that went into many of the... the model's already made for you, thank God, because I...
Oh, you don't have to make them all.
Yeah, I... No,
and how big are the models?
They're like three, four inches across.
So they're small.
They're small.
They're smallish, but then you can display them.
But I already have 55, and it's still coming.
Right, and they're still coming.
It adds up really
fast. There's a Voyager. There's a USS Voyager.
Yeah.
There's an IKS Negvar Klingon. Oh, look at the paint job on
that.
So the funniest thing is you can't see a paint job in space.
Yeah.
Anyway, but
interestingly, when you flip through this and you look, this is another thing that Next Generation brought. Because up to this point, pretty much every time you saw spaceships in movies, spaceships are gray.
Yeah.
Spaceships are made out of metal. Metal's gray.
Yeah.
Maybe kind of white. Maybe a little bit of color splashed on, like in Star Wars, a little bit of red marking.
Yeah.
Star Trek, actually, in its design, because they started introducing a lot of ships and a lot of species, and you had to be able to tell the difference between them.
Oh, right.
They actually brought this idea of color into the design process.
Yeah.
That so they began adopting things like Klingon ships always had a green tint to them. You know, the Federation ships stood with the gray-white appearance. Then we had Romulan ships. They actually had a slightly different palette of green that attached to them.
Okay.
Ferengi ships had a kind of orange tone to them.
Okay.
So Star Trek, with the beginning of Star Trek, Next Generation, and through the franchise, right, each species sort of developed its own color palette, and it just made it much easier to tell the difference from one ship to another. It really brought, like, color as a differentiating factor on ship design as well. The other thing that they brought in was the idea of lighting, integrated lighting into the ships. I mean, you saw this a little bit in, like, the motion picture, but and some of the subsequent movies. But the idea that almost every ship that shows up in this show has glowy engine bits that shine
so cool.
through. And light is part of that design.
Yeah.
That kind of pulls, again, a little bit of that Close Encounters thing.
Okay.
That lets incorporate light and glow into these things.
Right.
And so...
a Vulcan Surak class, which has a circle and then essentially like a phaser coming out of it.
Well, that's the whole body of the ship. The Vulcan ships are cool because instead of having two warp nacelles, they have a ring. And the warp comes out of the ring.
Oh, so all right.
And
that's the science, magical science on that thing.
Yeah.
Right.
And so while we're getting this bounty of, you know, dozens upon dozens of ships out of the Star Trek franchise, then we also get into the other TV franchise near and dear to my heart's, which is Babylon 5.
Babylon 5, which Tamara Boyd, who I used to work with, used to just be like, it's better than Star Trek. I don't think you understand. I never did get to see Babylon 5.
Okay, there I will harangue you.
Yes.
Babylon 5 is
we
really,
can get in.
It was transformative.
We might have to watch that.
Andy would like us to now watch that.
5-year story arc that was planned in advance.
3 seasons.
The first three seasons.
I got to go through the fourth. I mean... you don't know what happened. You don't get to the ending if you don't go to the fourth. The fifth is the one people sometimes
are willing to bail on. But Babylon 5, now what did their ships look like?
Babylon 5 was the first TV show to go whole hog, nothing but computer graphics. There were no models for the show.
Okay.
Star Trek actually adopted this later, and it sort of infiltrated and eventually it took over. But with Babylon 5, from day one... full CG.
Okay.
And it gave them the ability...
And what year was that? Was that 90s?
That started in 90. Like, 93, I think, was when the pilot aired. And, like, January of 93. It was
and
basically...
it went through almost to the end of the 90s.
Deep Space Nine premiered, actually. It was
the
pilot of Babylon 5 came on the first season of Deep Space Nine. Also on a station.
Carrie Dobro was my acting coach for a year.
And Carrie Dobro was awesome.
On Babylon 5. She was also hilarious. She's a very, very funny woman. And I actually, in life, think we should have become friends. But I'm sure she has a life to lead. Anyway, it didn't happen.
But what Babylon 5 brought us was huge fleets of ships.
Because they could?
Yeah, in the pilot. Like, things you would never have seen on television before. And it gave it the other thing it brought, because these were all computer modeled, it brought a lot more color and patterns and markings onto ship design that we'd never seen before. Because now you just sort of call up textured surfaces and things, and you have all sorts of paneling, and you don't have to build it, right? You just have to paint things. So, like, the idea of, like, really colorful markings all over the ship, we'd never seen... a lot of that in the past.
And did they use it like Star Trek did, where it was different kinds
of... Yeah,
for
each species had its own sort of color palette and patterns and designs.
So you could tell the difference.
And of course, as a model maker, when I do make models, what that brought to me was a extra level of nightmarish turmoil and pain I have to go through, because all of a sudden I couldn't just paint the model a color and be done. No, this has this fractal noise pattern. It's textured. It's all over. I once spent an entire weekend from like... 6 p.m. on a Friday night to like 9 p.m. on a Sunday night, just painting up my model of the White Star, which was this beautiful, elegant, swoopy, organic ship that had this complex blue and gray, soft, airbrushy structure that was perfectly symmetric, semi-organic design. Like, yeah, that was...
that should have just been white, because it was called the White Star.
But it's part of what was beautiful was that patterning. But yes,
that's neat.
Bringing this whole ability, anything you could paint in Photoshop, you could have on the surface of the ship cleanly.
Okay.
So that was that whole era of ship design.
Right. And so we're still in the 90s. Were there, like, Is that when Men in Black came out, or Independence Day, or any of that?
Yeah, Independence Day. When did Independence Day came out? I jotted that down.
Because I think somewhere. That was 99.
Yeah, that was in the '90s, right? Yeah.
And it was flying saucers again.
And it was flying saucers again, but yeah. Like 10 mile wide flying saucers.
Right, a gigantoid,
very detailed, nerbly. You know,
that could also be run by a Mac.
That could also be taken down by a Mac.
Yeah, Mac, the mothership. Much. Yeah, you just upload a virus. Jeff Goldblum is very powerful. A lot of people don't know.
Yeah, no. So that was, and we also got like ships and, you know, TV shows like Space Above and Beyond, only one for one season. But
is that Space Marines?
Space Marines, yeah.
Yeah, Space Above and Beyond. Marines. They were very, I always wanted that to do better. And then it went away, but it only lasts like 4 or 5 episodes.
Yeah.
But there were probably 12.
Yeah. It was like a single season. And then, like, right at the end of the 90s, we got Farscape on Sci-Fi Channel.
Right, which I've seen a half a dozen of those, and I need to see more of those.
And Farscape's wonderful, and it introduced, it finally brought us back to the idea of the organic spaceship. The ship named Moya.
It was a living creature.
As a character. You had a ship that was an intelligent, organic creature. You had a pilot that was sort of biologically grafted into the ship, and your only way of communicating with the ship was through the pilot character, the alien, who's basically his species. They give up their independence to basically merge biologically with them.
Right.
And so it's very lovely when you have a show where, when, you know, it's one thing to go up to the console and say, set in a course for Solaris 7, versus having to have an argument with the pilot thing, I want to go here. Well, Moya doesn't really want to go there. Well, we really do, and it's important. Well, she actually is going to head this other direction. No, I mean, come on. Mm-hmm, you actually have to argue and negotiate with your ship. I mean, that does add
a nice level to the to the travel.
So finally back to organic designs. We start to see more and more of. Then we're up to the 2000s.
Okay.
And then the next big thing that happened to spaceships in the 2000s comes like really in this big lump of movies that kind of all hit at the same time. And this would be like Cowboys and Aliens, Battle Los Angeles, Battleship, John Carter. And the thing that happened there. Again,
what did I see? Did I see any of those?
John Carter's we're seeing.
Okay. You know, I saw Cowboys and Aliens and then I think maybe one other. All right.
But here's the era where basically at this point, everyone knows how to do solid ships. It's easy. It's simple. But, you know, we're doing now, CG is really into character animation and complex characters that are actually, you know, golems and things.
Right.
So to carry this idea of character animation to the ships, it introduced the idea of articulated ships. So this is basically picking up where some X-Wings really started us. The idea that ships could move around a little bit and change their shape, continued
Serenity.
A little bit in the Star Wars. Yeah, Serenity, rotating engines and things. But even more, when you get to movies like Cowboys and Aliens, where it's not just like one little pivot thing, but whole complex armatures of overlapping plates and things that shift, literally hundreds of moving parts.
Oh.
I mean, this is sort of the era after, right when we get Transformers and the idea of these really complex mechanical systems interact.
Yeah.
That design gets carried over into ship design. And now all of a sudden, to be really cool, the ships actually have to have like complex articulation and
right, and they can armor themselves or something.
Armor themselves,
kind of, like all of a sudden, and then they cover themselves, and you're like, oh wow, so that is CGI,
right? Though, so. but you know, just appearing, right? That's kind of '90s stuff, right? Now
okay.
It has to actually animate and slide into position. You have to have like this whole
and you get
sense
to see it
structure.
Or something. Okay, see,
and then this is really a design style that really is continuing on to today. And this even like last year, Jupiter Ascending, awful movie. Beautiful art design. but, you know, the idea of taking it even further where it's a technology, a very advanced technology they're rendering in their ships, but where the articulations are actually independently floating elements that are somehow tied together through complex force fields rather than being physically attached.
Will you go see a movie
complex.
Just if it has spaceships in it?
Oh, hell yes.
Oh, my God. I should have seen that coming. I'm so sorry.
No, it's I'm perfectly capable of turning off what all the yappy people are saying about any movie and just sit back. If there is beautiful art design and direction and visual effects, I feel it's often
it's a different movie.
It's a different movie. It's not necessarily the one the writer or the director intended, but it's worth seeing. And I feel like visual effects gets a very bad rap for ruining. I mean, people blame it for ruining movies. And I think what people don't really understand is. Visual effects doesn't ruin movies, you know. Visual effects actually take something that has no redeeming value whatsoever and turns it into something that you can actually sit back and like enjoy. It's pretty. And
right.
At least it gave you something to enjoy about it.
But can crummy visual effects ruin a movie?
Crummy visual effects can certainly detract from your enjoyment of the movie.
Right.
But the thing is, if the movie is really, really good, then
it can rise above.
It doesn't even
the
matter
effects.
Whether the effects are good. Right. It rises above. You carry along. You enjoy
but,
it
and, but
for, you're, 'cause you're drawn into it.
And the opposite of that, so where the visual effects are amazing, but the storyline or the dialogue is not great, it can help it make it more palatable.
It make it more palatable, but it won't make it a good movie.
Right.
But
fair enough.
I feel like I always want to emphasize that even if the movie is bad, say through something that the writers had done or that the way the director chose to bring it, don't let that make you hate what might be a beautiful work of art created by the visual effects.
Right, there's
right.
still good work going
there's
on.
There's still good work. It can still be beautiful. It can still transport you visually to a new world. And don't blame the visual effects. for the writing or the direction.
Right, the visual effects were as good as they possibly could be, and the writing and the direction of the movie were just bad.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
That's not the problem of the visual effects. Fair enough.
So this basically takes us up to I guess the modern era and sort of where we are in chip design. I think. The thing that we've seen a kind of resurgence in very recently in film, again, you can kind of point back to 2001, but this we have this spate of films now that are out where we're really focused back on realistic designs, like what would actually work in a physics sense. And you look at, say, the art design in a movie like Interstellar, where they built these ships to, you know, rotating sections. It's just meticulously designed as a plausible way of an entry craft, a transportation craft would work. You know, movies like Gravity, where the technology actually, you know, they didn't invent anything for gravity, but, you know, they were using the space shuttle design, the space station design, but again, trying to show weightlessness and zero G environments and what that was like. We have, you know, a significant return to this desire to, you know, render that zero G, like if you don't have a rotating section, then you don't have gravity. And how do you interact in the ship and make that work? The Martian.
Yeah.
Incredible, beautiful design of the ships and the environments, but all based on a kind of reality to it. They want it to be plausible, at least in the way it works.
Did it seem like something like they had real science that they were trying to...
Oh, absolutely.
That Donald Glover was coming up with.
Yeah. No, I think, in The Martian in particular, I think, you know, they struck a really nice balance between designing something that you want it to look beautiful to engage the audience visually.
Yeah.
But then when you actually look at how all the pieces work, there's a rotating, big rotating section for the gravity, the sense of, you know, the timing of, you know, you can't just turn the ship around and fly back to Mars. You actually have to slingshot back around the Earth and go out, right? The actual attention to how gravitational dynamics work and how you actually have to physically move things around a solar system. It's not just turn and suddenly you're moving in a different direction. You know, that's the downside of what we carry along from Star Trek. But in fact, if you want to push back to, again, come back to Babylon 5, which was first in many important ways.
Yeah.
Babylon 5 was one of the first times on television they really tried to establish this sense of how physics would really work on the having a big cylindrical station that rotates to create gravity. Some of these beautiful vistas where you sit inside this big cylinder, seeing it curving up above you. Imagery that we later saw in movies like Interstellar, which was one of the first times we've ever seen the inside of a cylindrical habitat since Babylon 5 first showed it to us on television.
So the cylindrical habitat is artificially creating gravity.
Yes, by rotating.
Okay. Is that a feast? Like, because I once said to your and Andy's mutual friend from back in the day, Judy Adler, who teaches physics at the high school level, AP, no doubt. And, but she, I once said to her, can we make gravity? Can we control gravity out in space? And she just looked at me, and as did her son, who I believe was 10 at the time. And she was like, no, not yet. Not yet, Jackie. That's still not real.
Let's be careful. We can't make gravity. We cannot generate a gravitational field like in Star Trek. Like a plate that suddenly you step on it and you stick to it. Right.
Right.
We can't do that. But we can simulate the effect of gravity through centrifugal force
For real.
Rotation, for real. And we've been doing that in amusement parks forever, right? You know,
but we can do that in space?
We train astronauts in simulators that spin them around in a centrifuge to help them experience what, you know, 3 Gs of acceleration feel like.
Okay.
On the ship. So,
yeah.
And we can do that in space. That is totally, utterly doable.
Okay. But we haven't figured out how to sort of work it so that we can spin super fast and then get shit done while we're spinning fast.
I mean, in theory, we can. I think the reason we haven't done it yet is just it's expensive. You have to build a relatively large space to do this. You know, if you build the centrifuge and you try to live in it, the other thing you discover if you know, the spinny things, like the part where you're against the wall. And one of the things they tell you is don't move your head around.
Yeah.
Because, you know, as soon as you bend your head up, you want to throw up.
Yeah.
So imagine living in that.
Yes.
Every time you turn your head, you're ready to puke, right?
Right.
You can't build one of these things and have it like 20 feet in diameter or 50 feet in diameter.
Have to be bigger than that so that it wouldn't feel like it'd be the size of the Earth would help.
Yeah.
Because it is also
your
spinning.
Your brain would really react to the fact that the amount of, you know, kind of simulated gravity is a function of how close you are to the wall versus the center.
Yeah.
And if the diameter is relatively small compared to the distance between your head and your feet, then the differential, like, that creates nausea. So that's why you would probably, it'd have to be a big space station kind of
thing. Did you read C.S. Lewis's Out of the Silent Planet?
I did not read C.S. Lewis.
C.S. Lewis's Out of the Silent Planet. In the first book, they get in a spaceship, which is shaped like a ball. And they have control of gravity in the center of the spaceship. They have essentially, like, for some reason, they've controlled gravity. They've created, like, a center of the Earth kind of sitch.
Mm-hmm.
So they walk across the outside of it. That's how their gravity works on the spaceship. They walk on the outside of the center of the ball. So, like, sometimes they're upside down.
Okay, well, you have to, like, That requires gravity creation.
Total magical gravity creation and written in like 1940. So he doesn't have any actual science available to him because he's an English professor from Oxford.
But, anyway, you know, we can forgive shows for having magical gravity creation because, let's face it, it's actually really expensive to make people pretend to be in zero G the entire TV series. You know, you have to.
Fair enough.
So, you know, we have
unforeseen side that I didn't think about that. Yeah. Of course, it would be very expensive to have people be in zero G all the time.
Yeah.
All right. But, I have two movies to ask you about. Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. That had a spaceship. Improbability Drive, I think.
The Heart of Gold. Yes.
That was it.
The Infinite Improbability Drive for
it was in the Heart of Gold. That's it.
For mechanisms for getting your ship from point A to point B, it's one of the most brilliant concepts in all of science fiction history.
Yeah.
The idea of basing it on a pure generation of improbability and the idea that you basically generate a field that creates things that are so improbable that the likelihood of ending up where you actually want to is so vastly improbable. If you've now made the improbable probable, that's where you'll be. That's just stunningly brilliant.
It's just good writing.
Douglas Adams, you know, will live with us forever
as a genius that he is. And then Firefly.
And Firefly.
Which we didn't bring up because I think that is a very pretty ship.
It is a very pretty ship.
It's a mess. Like, it looks like a junker. It looks like the Millennium Falcon.
Yes.
To me.
Yes.
It has that kind of resonance with me.
But it's noteworthy for having one of the most beautiful examples of integrated set and ship design, because the actual set they built for that absolutely follows the contours. I mean, you can buy replicas of the Serenity that you pop the top off and you actually see all the sets, the dining room, everything. It's all there. The little windows in the dining room that look out. It's all like geographically fit. Even the levels and the big
because they slide down.
And they slide down into the big storage bay thing. Yeah, they thought that whole thing through and they built it and designed the sets to even the sets that they kind of like, you kind of half walk upstairs and there's art and that's falling kind of the spine of the ship.
That's
really
cool.
Incredible design, beautiful done, and noteworthy because they were one of the few shows ever to face and stare down the "in space you shouldn't hear any noise" and say, okay, we're going to do it that way, and they made it work. You always hear the argument, well, it'll be boring if we don't hear sound effects, so we're going to put sound effects in. They nulled the sound every time they were in space, and they used music to create drama.
Okay.
And it was incredibly effective.
There we go.
Yeah. So,
what is the future of space travel on television? Because we are, my friend, at an hour 15.
No. All right. Well, two things. Let me first jump back. I forgot to mention. I told you my favorite starship, which is the Enterprise.
Yep.
The refit. I told you my favorite transport ship, which would be the Eagle from Space 1999.
Right.
I did not tell you my favorite fighter ship.
Oh, right.
And people will probably jump to, of course, it's the X-Wing. But nope. I actually have to go to Babylon 5, the Star Fury.
The first
space fighter craft we ever saw that showed that you would mount engines that could fire forward and backward. That in order to decelerate, you don't just turn your ship and you go in a different direction.
Oh,
you actually have to fire jets in a different direction and slow down and then turn around.
And create maneuverability.
Yes.
Okay.
So Babylon 5 has the record for being the first show to actually show how a fighter would fire control jets to kind of tumble around and flip around.
Yeah.
Mesmerizingly beautiful and actually scientifically accurate.
All right.
Now, some of the aliens, of course, did the swoop thing and that, but they at least did it right for the Star Fury. So the Star Fury takes a position
that's
of honor.
Your fighter.
That's
your fighter one.
Yeah.
All right.
But the thing to watch in the future, I think, I have just watched the pilot of a new series for Sci-Fi Channel called The Expanse.
Okay.
It's based apparently on a series of novels. I'm not sure who the writer was, but it's premiering in December. And I think January, they're going to kind of run through the whole thing.
Yeah.
And that's set, say, I'm guessing like 200 years in the future where mm-hmm. we've colonized the solar system. But the fact that turning a ship around in this pilot to basically intercept a distress call when they were en route to Mars and they have to decide, oh, no, we have to do this. Just turning the ship around, changing course is such a major event that it's actually a plot point in the story. It's like, oh yeah, they actually, this is good.
This is a big, good
they're
for them.
They're actually really, they're trying to be incredibly plausible. A lot of beautiful zero G work in the movie. They're trying to show as much of that as they can find feasible, looking at like plausible colonization scenarios for the asteroids and for Mars.
Right.
Lots of geopolitical intrigue,
all
spatial,
good.
Spatio-political intrigue, I guess.
Yeah. And new Battlestar Galactica? You didn't mention that either. Is that
new Battlestar, again, brilliantly beautiful. Only so many minutes in the day, but
exactly.
They also did a good job of showing reaction control thrusters to maneuver. They actually picked up the tradition from the Star Furies.
Yeah.
And again, did a beautiful job. Also, disconnecting, showing the camera tracking ships. You know, the classic Battlestar had the problem of they had to make the Vipers look like they're moving. So you'd be sitting in the cockpit and you'd just see stars streaming outside. It's like, you know.
Like Fred Flintstone. Yes.
You know, the stars aren't like the lampposts that are, you know, 20 feet away. They're like, you know, 1,000 light years away and they're stars. And, you know, like you wouldn't see that. So the new Battlestar set did this idea of, you know, we're just fixed camera and we're tracking
okay.
them against the stars. So you get the motion, but you also don't break the reality of the fact that they are not actually flying between the stars.
Robert Hurt, you remain fascinating. Fascinating and awesome. And what do you want to talk about next time?
Oh, man, I haven't
The dorkdoms, there's rows and rows of them, I'm pretty sure.
Yes, well, you know, honestly, I can just return to some of the cool stuff that's happened in astronomy and space science since then, you know, I mean, like...
Fair enough. And if people follow you...
The discovery of possible signatures of parallel universes, you know, how...
What?
Press release next week, which will be like 2 weeks ago by the time this comes out.
Exactly. So. At Astro Rob on Twitter, Astronomy Viz... on WordPress and astropics.cool in the world of the internet. Thanks a lot for being on the show, Robert.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks, Andy, for watching. And you guys know the rules. Take care of each other out there. Bye.
My hat, my hat, my hat. They're dancing around my hat. My hat, my hat, my hat. Well, what do you think of that? If it looks like a Mexican hat dance and it sounds like a Mexican hat dance, it's most likely a Mexican hat dance. So take off your hat and let's dance.
Yay! Oh my God. Why don't we just call that as the end of the show?